Hello and welcome to the EV Cafe Takeaway, a podcast focused on the zero emission future that we all hope for. And every week I'm joined by a wonderful member of the EV Cafe, and this week's no exception. I've got the lovely John Curtis. John, good day to you and welcome.
Greetings. How are you, my friend? Are you well?
I'm buzzing like a buzzy thing. Yes. And how about you?
I'm also buzzing like a buzzy thing. Please send in descriptions of which buzzy things you think Paul and I are most like. I'll take B, thank you. Let's get on with it.
Indeed, let's do that, because every week we get the privilege and pleasure of getting to know some of the innovators, pioneers and collaborators of our industry. And this week we are absolutely thoroughly thrilled to be joined by James Starling, the MD of the AA Business Services. Fantastic. James, welcome to you.
Hello, thank you for joining. I was looking over my shoulder to see who you were talking about. I wasn't quite sure. Best introduction I've ever had, actually. Thank you very much.
To be fair, James, it was the script for the last person, but we just thought we'd use it again. It's fine.
No offence taken.
Oh, there was plenty meant. No, I'm kidding. James, so I gave you your full title there, the MD of the AA Business Services, because many of us will know all about the AA because, you know, they're breakdown people. They're the people that sometimes termed the fourth emergency service, or, you know, all of those good things. Yeah. But there is that little qualification of the business services element. Tell us a little bit about the specific bit of the AA that you're looking after and how it's more than just what we've talked about.
Okay. Let's just stand back a level then, if I may. I would say the AA is split into three big buckets. We have the insurance world, the insurance part of our business. So a lot of people have motor insurance, household insurance, and we provide that for our customers. That's roughly one third of our business. And then we have two parts to our business, the retail consumer bit of the AA, which is synonymous with breakdown. And that's probably, I'd say a strong 35% of our business. And then you have my world, which is business services, which is like a 30%, similar size to the insurance, a little bit behind the pure roadside and the retail world. But let's then describe what that is within that, if I may. So core to our product proposition in business services is obviously our roadside product, and we have three distinctive sales channels. Sales channels number one is we partner with a lot of OEMs. And the OEMs, as part of your new car offering, will have an AA breakdown cover for the first, third, second, third year. And we have a partnership with OEMs that you can bet the customers can benefit from. Our second sales channel is, I'm going to call it finance institutions added value card assistance. So, for example, I have a platinum card with a well-known bank in the UK. And as a result of that, I benefit. Yes, okay. I'm delighted to say it's not Coop, so I'm not a Nigel Farage one. I don't know if I can say that. It's probably too late. With that, quite often comes membership benefits. And sometimes breakdown cover is included in your card benefit of your bank card. So you get that. And also sometimes if you happen to have home insurance or car insurance, you get that added value benefit as well. So again, sometimes breakdown cover and so on. So that's channel number two. And then for those people lucky enough to have lease cars, so a lot of our big lease partners in the UK, LeasePlan, Lex, et cetera, have roadside cover, and you can get it through that channel. The final channel is my smallest channel, but very important, is we do direct to the small business user. So we have an SME channel where small, medium enterprise not served by those other areas can come direct to us and buy smaller policies, more aligned to retail, but effectively in a business world. So those are
James, that's really interesting to me, because when you're a small business, you think that, oh, I can't possibly get anything which is a little more bespoke, off the shelf, something which is more fitting for my business. Definitely. But with the AA, you can. You've got this department which is able to flex a little. Can you explain a little how you support the SME sector in the AA?
Okay, so in my particular world, it's, as I said, it's my smallest channel by size and scale, but nevertheless, we have thousands of clients who participate. These are generally the, can I say, the butcher candlestick maker type size? So running, I'm going to say, a fleet between 3 and 15, typically in that 3 to 25. And what they can come to our website. Let me use taxis as a great example. It's very difficult to get roadside cover if you're a taxi operator because it's not a retail use vehicles. It's used for business use. So we have a bespoke policy that can come in and actually get a tailored policy for you at a point of origination. So it's fit for purpose, probably going to cover a higher propensity of breakdowns because of its typical usage. And it's the right product for the right customer, in our view, at the right price point. And so we have that type of ability for the consumer or the small business user in that scenario to come and tailor and get that product. Also, I'd also say there's a different usage between car and commercial. So again, if you are a commercial vehicle user, again, your requirements of the asset are somewhat different versus that of a car. So again, subtly tailored, subtly different for each type of mix. But of course, the same is true for the OEMs and those big channels, but certainly we do that as well for the SME as well. So they're getting
Does it throw up any interesting, unusual requests and requirements of the AA? I mean, you must get some pretty odd questions asked in that bespoke area.
We do. I suppose the rather obvious one, I don't know, is funeral care vehicles. And I don't know where I'm going to go with this one, but of course, breaking down with, you know, obviously one would never want that. That must be one of the worst events, you know, you could imagine. But nevertheless, you know, bespoke service for that type of arrangement is required. At the end of the day, they're still using a vehicle for onward mobility. You know, they need, you know, it's difficult to have an onward mobility vehicle in that scenario, but nevertheless, to provide breakdown services for that type of product is an example of a very peculiar type of requirement that you are often asked to do. The other thing you do as you kind of move up the size and scale is obviously some of the unique SLAs that we get asked to do and provide. And again, those are generally done at the more bigger level. But again, there are some quite interesting ones there that we work on with clients.
Wow. Good to know you've got that flexibility. And I know as we develop the broader EV strategy as a nation, that people are going to be coming more and more to you for that bespoke service at the SME level. That's really good.
At the SME level, I will say this, though, is... You know, we're experts at what we do, and you don't want too much cannibalization of process, if I'm being honest. I genuinely want us to strive and to achieve to have you know, sort of like 90% standardization, because therefore that makes us more efficient and able to deal with the vast majority of it. I do passionately believe we're the experts at what we do. And if you have too much customization, it then affects your service at the front end. So we have to make sure that we don't go too far. But that's something we're constantly looking at and evolving.
I think that's, James, you know, both of our careers crossed over in a particular place at one point. I think you were there slightly before me, but in LeasePlan. And I know that actually a lot of... They say a camel is a horse designed by a committee. You know, it's a bit funny looking. It's got, you know, humps and, you know, spits in your face. And we end up with that, don't we? That if we go too far sometimes in terms of trying to make everything fit, rather than get the customer to trust our expertise, you just mentioned being the experts in the place. And I think what you provide to the market is well thought through, robust solutions that people can trust. And this EV journey is a difficult one, isn't it? The, you know, and we need to be able to trust the experts.
Yeah, we've had, you know, there are a number of views on how to serve. Like, let's deal with EV breakdowns because it's an interesting an area at this moment in time. We are evolving our EV breakdown strategy at this moment in time. And I think through learnings and understanding, we're improving that service. Our worldview, and has been for a wee while, is that if you break down and because you don't have charge in the same way that you would break down if unfortunately you didn't have enough petrol in the car. Our kind of move is to move the people away from the site in a safe and secure way. We're not of the view today that we want to charge people at roadside and top up. Now, admittedly, we do that through the fuel can, but the fuel can loading up is a very rapid process. Mm. And I think we've got on that sort of journey. Now, I think, funnily enough, as charging technology improves and you can do really rapid charging, and we have the ability to have rapid chargers, which we are testing, by the way, that we can do a rapid charge, I mean, in just a couple of minutes, then our worldview may change. But today, that's our current philosophy on dealing with breakdowns with electric vehicles at the roadside. But that will evolve as technology improves, is my current view.
Yeah, and I'm 100% with you. I think the joy of technology coming to support the challenges that we face, and roadside charging for a vehicle, and of course a very small percentage of vehicles, but the small percentage of vehicles that do run out is certainly one area where we're going to see some development, I'm almost certain, given what we know today. Well, James, it's fantastic kind of getting an overview of how you landed into the AA and what the AA Business Services does. It's a fantastic and a diverse business, obviously meeting a hell of a lot of needs. But how did James end up here? Because, I mean, you know, managing director of a significant blue chip company is, I mean, a role that many people would aspire to as they grow up. But what were you thinking about? And publishable, please, in the classrooms as you grew up in school and went out into the big wide world. You know, how was life for you then, and how did it form who you are now?
So really briefly, I can go back to the classroom event where I had mapped my career from when I was about 15 right the way to I was 40. And what I did was, and I've used this a lot as I've learned and got older in a more sophisticated way, but in principle it went like this. I could see 5 years in front of me in 5-year blocks really easy. And I found 5-year blocks really worked for me in terms of my mindset. So at 5 to 15, I knew exactly what I wanted to do in my private life and in my academic life at that stage. I could see it from 20 to 25 and so on and so forth. And I was right up to 40. So just really quickly, so 15 to 20 was I wanted to study, get the best exam results I could, go to the best university I could. That was roughly my work world. My private life was, as in, what did I want to achieve personally? I wanted to be the best athlete I could. I was quite a good athlete. I ran for Great Britain, so I was fairly good. So I said I wanted to be the best athlete I can. I want to go to world championships and all that sort of stuff. So I did that when I did that. And I think what I also had is my end game at 40. It was really corny, but I said I wanted to be a main board director of a PLC firm by the time I was 40. Come back to that in a second. So then it was 20 to 25. It was, I wanted to be the best athlete I could. I wanted to be a chartered accountant. So trained as a chartered accountant, did all that stuff. And then I realized I wasn't a very good chartered accountant. So I thought, you know what? I thought to myself, well, what do I really like? I like automobiles, and I work for a company called Coopers and Lybrand, now PwC. They did the audit for Ford Motor Company, and they introduced me to Ford Motor Company, and I was lucky enough to start my career in the automotive world. And Ford were amazing. They looked after me brilliantly as an employee, and then they let me also still pursue my athletic endeavours. So I worked a short work week, so I could train still really hard. I was lucky enough to go to more world championships. And that was it, really, still with my ambitions. So then at 30 to 35, I also knew I guess I wanted to have family, own my own house. These are my private aspirations. I was coming to the end of my athletic career, and I said, right, I'm now going to focus my endeavours on, you know, on work. Took the decision to move on from Ford and then develop my career in another OEM, and enjoyed my time there. And then I went to work in a consulting firm, which was great. I had 4 years working for a company called White Clark Group, which was, for me, amazing. They were heavily involved in the like motor and financial services world, and had a wonderful kind of education and training there. And then I went from there to LeasePlan. And then I will say this, I met the best manager, I have to say, today, I've ever worked with in my career. And And what he enabled me to do was he excited me about, I guess, my level of ability, but he enabled me to see shades of grey, which I didn't see in my earlier career. And I think my biggest problem for me as a young manager, I was still in athletic mode, and I had been a really good athlete, and everything's black and white when you're an athlete, and you're either good or you're bad. And as a manager, I was too black and white, because you can imagine some of the conversations that might have gone if you're very black and white. You tell people you're not as good as you think you are. And I'm doing it with all honesty and sincerity. And no matter how I tried, I wasn't very good at it. Even though I was trying to be sincere, I think the people receiving it. He got me to see shades of grey, and he just gave me these wonderful stories. And he, although he was my manager, and I'm going to say his name, is a guy called Adam Wigginton. And for me, he was the best manager I've ever worked with. And to this day, I owe him all the subsequent developments in my career. I was then lucky enough to become a main board director of Toyota Financial Services in the UK, and worked with Toyota Motor Company. I had a wonderful time there. And then the 2008 banking crisis came. And so I'd only been in there two and a bit years. I think I've made a difference, but unfortunately I lost my role. And I had to start from scratch again, literally started from scratch. And I'm eternally grateful to my friends at Lex Auto Lease, who took me on as a salesperson again at the start of a career almost. And I remembered I was being interviewed by, I'm going to say his name as well, a guy called Jeremy Heron, who has and remains a really good friend of mine, took the gamble on recruiting a person who was quite senior to start again.
Mm.
And he took a bit of a gamble on him. And I remember in the interview, I don't know if I'm going to say it too late. He said to me, I'm not sure if I should do this. And I said, Jeremy, don't worry. This will be the best decision you've ever made. And I backed myself to see if I could sell pure leasing to the market. And I think I did a pretty good job for Jeremy. And I was lucky enough then to become head of function. I was grew to lead the new business function at Lex. Then I headed up the account management at Lex. Had a great time there, 10 years there, trained me brilliantly, loved it. And I thought to myself, do I want to stay in here and be part of a big corporate, or do I want to back myself and do something a bit different? So then I had the opportunity to work for a company called SMH, which is a private equity owned firm that was into vehicle refurbishment and onward mobility and all that sort of stuff. I was very lucky there. Well, it's not lucky. As Gary Player said, the more I practice, the luckier I get.
That's it.
We worked really hard when I was there, and we were very fortunate to be acquired by a brand that everyone knows and is a bit Marmite for some people. We were acquired by Cazoo, and Cazoo bought us very much for their inward servicing of their vehicle requirements. They changed and restructured what was an outward looking to an inward focused business. It was a service to support the business. I'm not about that. I'm a revenue line grower and an EBITDA line grower, not an internal fulfillment. And then I owned and I did all want to work. And literally, I was only going to iron about it. I could retire. And I was lucky enough to be approached by the AA, and the rest is history. So that's a very long story cut incredibly short. So I went through all of those professional accountant, working for some great OEMs, about to really have a go and test myself. Now I'm at the AA, and what a company to work for.
Something which fascinates me, James, about you is your structured approach to your career, and that you, using your accountancy brain, I guess, put things into boxes and you like to have those squared away.
Yeah.
But really interesting, I'm an ex-rugby player, discus thrower at county level. Certainly nothing like you, but sports psychology has been part of my life, that being trained to be the best you can be, to win, to not accept second place, to keep trying. Are those qualities that you see in yourself along with others? And does that psychology still stay with you, that early training? Has that helped to shape the man?
It's been a great help to me, but it's also been a burden. As I said earlier in my career, where I was too black and white, when you're an athlete at my standard, I was lucky enough to go to a few world championships, you're ruthless in the way that you assess your own performance. And I use that term really quite deliberately.
Yeah.
And And I never saw any harm in that because that's about making me better and all that sort of thing. So I just assume everyone was like that. But of course, not everyone is. No. So that was the curse of being an athlete. The great strength of it is, of course, the resilience that you show. And actually, back to my best manager, Adam Wiggins. So I've got to use this story. He did this with me. When he was working in America, he worked with a guy called Admiral Jim Stockdale. And there's a famous thing called the Stockdale Principle. And he was a prisoner of war in the Vietnam War. So he probably wasn't the best war person at that time of being a prisoner of war for about 3 or 5 years. But he was actually kept in the most horrific conditions in Vietnam. And he held on to two completely biometrically opposed forts. And he thought, today, my life couldn't be any worse than it is today. But I know tomorrow or one day it will be better. And you stand back and you think about that. And that in itself is life to a T, isn't it? I've got targets, whether it be at work or personal or whatever I have. And I think, oh my God, I don't know how I'm going to do it. And you worry about it, but I always hold on that contradictory view that I know no matter what, I'll find my way through it and tomorrow will be better. And I find as I started to think and reflect about that, that's life itself. And I kind of brought that with me alongside my absolute resilience and sometimes stubbornness, to do things. And it just really helped me. These are kind of certain North Stars that I have. Mm. And I think the other thing that I've done is I've spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, like how you articulate selling, for want of a better expression, to customers and what's important. And again, I try to keep things really simple because everyone has a way of making selling so complicated. I think it's incredibly easy. Mm. And it's because people actually forget about the end customer in my experience. They want to talk about their product. And all that sort of thing, but they forget what actually is the driving, motivating factors for why a customer actually wants to buy your bloody product in the first place. And if you never answer that, then you never sell. And so I spend a lot of time making sure I really understand who's buying from me and what are their motivations for buying. So
can I pick up on that? What do you find is the thing which time and time people say to you is the reason why they buy from the AA?
Well, I don't think there's any one clear reason. So let me, if I may, just spend a little bit of time how I kind of bucket sort of people, if I may. So when I think about selling to any customer, and that's whether it's the AA, SMH, the leasing companies that I work for, I think you want to understand the customer in four sort of like areas. So area one, it's, and certainly in business services, is around giving me an outstanding customer experience. So in other words, the end customer who is receiving the experience in the moment, you want to be faultless in that. You want to execute that to make that as in the service that we provide, you want to be there as quick as you can. You want to fix it at the roadside as if you can. And if you don't, you then want to take it to a garage agent and then you want to get the person onward and mobile. Make it as easy and simple to use as possible. Second thing you've got to do, and certainly when you're doing a beta world, is provide value. I hate the term cost because as soon as you go cost, you go into salami pricing and I don't really want to do it. But you've got to provide value to the customer. So I try to kind of look at it is rather than look at a transactional element to it, you look back and you say, what's the total cost of the provision of this wonderful all-round service that might not just be roadside, it's about onward mobility. You might have had an accident. How can we help you? Can we help you with service maintenance and repair? And look at it that way. So you're looking at the whole value package. I think the next thing, again, when you're selling to businesses, firms, you've got to have fiduciary and regulatory compliance. So for example, if you've broken down, are we using proper parts? If you're doing and providing service maintenance repair, are we giving you a good, valid service maintenance and repair option? Are we doing MOTs for you? Blah, 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 blah. So you have to be compliant. You also have to provide consolidated invoicing that's really simple and easy to understand and all that sort of thing to make it easy for the customer. And the fourth bucket is the most esoteric of them all, is what are you doing for me with regards to innovation? And that's quite a difficult one because what does innovation actually mean? I think it's the way that the AA is evolving to move from just pure breakdown, which is what we're synonymous with. Part of my job as leading business services within the AA is I've got this little mission. Today, well, when I joined, sorry, let's get this correct. When I joined, about 97% of all of our revenues were from breakdown. My aspirations within the next 3 to 4 years is to get that to 85%. So I'm looking to develop revenue sources from other areas, like I said, accident management, mobility, service maintenance and repair, our selling of our, we've got a division that I look after called Drive Tech. So we do the online driver training for drivers. We also, as you may or may not know, if you're unfortunate enough to get caught by the police for speeding, we do the speeding awareness courses for them as well. So I'm trying to develop all of those areas and get more revenue from there. So that's what I'm trying to do.
They're good, aren't they, Paul, those speed awareness courses?
What are they? I don't know anything about them. I'm usually go to jail, go directly to jail, don't pass go, and don't get a speed awareness course. James, it's fantastic to hear the clarity of thought. I was lucky enough recently to interview a CEO of a business, and my question to him was, what does being a CEO mean? And he was able to articulate it really well. And it was a real education. But equally here, right now, there's a really clear vision, really clear mission that you are on. And it seems that that's personified your life all the way through. You've talked about resilience. I mean, if we look at John and I look at our own lives, we know that we have not always been as resilient as we'd like. And we've caved through the ice many a time and come up against many, many walls. I'm curious, does somebody in like you that has that athletic ability and that sort of competitive mindset, this really clear vision, this very definite goal, do you still hit walls? I mean, have you had to recall a time in your life where you really had to dig deep and you know, things have like felt like it's coming to an end, or have you managed to keep pressing?
Do you know what? I think this is one of my big problems. Why I probably wasn't. I don't think I was a particularly good manager until probably in my 40s, if I'm being honest. Again, I get back to I was too black and white. And if I'm genuinely honest, I needed some some shit to happen to me. And that moment happened in my. I had a couple of big moments. In my early 40s, both my wife and I were really seriously ill. My wife had cancer, and I was being read the last rites at one particular stage, and literally was nearly on kind of on death's door. And I do remember coming back from that about 2.5 months after. I'll eventually get to the point and answer the question. Is I do remember about 2.5 months after the illness, I got onto my push bike for the first time, and I've got this amazing sort of like. very expensive push bike, and I could hardly ride the bike, but I knew I was recovering because I could ride the bike, and whereas I wasn't able to do anything. I kid you not, I'm on this unbelievable racing bike, and this woman went by with her beg up sort of like thing with a basket on the front, and as she went screaming by me doing probably about 10-15 miles an hour, I knew I was on the road to recovery, and she looked at me, she said, "Well done, Nipper. I needed that to happen in my life, and that actually changed my whole life on risk, if I'm being honest. I'm very conservative. It might not come across that way, but in the way that I think financially, in the way that I think or as a partnership, we think very financially, and we took some risks that we wouldn't have done at that particular time. I think the other thing as well, in my career, I'd never had a bad day. And I talk about my experience with Toyota. I really loved working for Toyota, and I have nothing but praise for them. Unfortunately, though, when the 2008 banking crisis came, I lost my job because of that. And there was nothing personal. It was all business, but it could have consumed me and actually made me a bit bitter about it, blah, blah, blah. I was in the moment, don't get me wrong. I was really upset about it. But actually it's not what you do, and you can be consumed by it, or you can focus and look ahead. And I'm back to the Stockdale principle. My life couldn't be any worse than it is today, but I know tomorrow it will be better. And that became my focus. And I also had to recalibrate my 5-year program. That was almost at when I was 40. So I've got to 40, main board director of this huge global firm, Toyota. And I had to start again. So So I reset my calibration and you just do it. But I needed those shit moments to become a good manager. And sorry for using that term, but that's helped me evolve as a person. And then, like all families, then you also have other personal challenges that you have and face, and you deal with those. And I've had a couple since then, which I won't go into too much detail on this call about, but I think those shaped me and made me a much better manager. I think you need world experience to be a good manager. I defy anyone to not have had, well, if you've had everything rosy, I don't think you can be a brilliant manager. Or I defy you to be a brilliant manager.
Yeah.
So there we go.
I mean, it's really helpful to kind of get that context, because I'm trying, you know, I look at athletes, particularly, you know, from, I just, whilst I hadn't realised, and forgive me, that your
That's right.
athletic career was quite what it was, but you were pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just looking at, you know, some, it is, I presume it's you that had the best time of 1:51 for the 800 metres. Is that you?
Well, I was a little bit quicker than that, but that's one of the times. Yeah, the best I got was 11th in the World Road Relay Championships.
Yes, I saw that.
In the World Championships. So that was there. From the top Europeans in cross country. So yeah, really enjoyed my time. But that was a long time.
How did you take losing?
Oh, I was an awful loser. I've been lucky as well. I've also raced and trained with athletes who are far better than me. I had the pleasure of training with Cohen Ovett.
Wow.
And all that sort of guys. Yeah. And the one thing you do see from all of these, and they're at a different level to me. I got in one moment in my career, I was the 11th best in the world. But that's what you train for, that one moment to be that good. But these guys were at the top of the game for many, many years. And they actually, people tell me focus, and it is. But it's also selfishness. And one kind of silly story about this. I was lucky enough just to go to the World Cross Country. I was 31 at the time, which I think was in Morocco. I came back for about 3 weeks, and my second child was being born just in that moment. But I had to go off to Brazil to race in the World Road Relays, actually. And my mother-in-law said, "What are you doing going away like that?" And my wife and I both looked at her and said, "Look, this is my kind of almost second job, for want of a better expression." Mm. I was coming to the end of my athletic career. And I thought, well, World Championships, I don't think my daughter, who was a baby at that stage, remembers me at that stage. So you take that selfish decision, but in agreement with my wife, and you go off and do these things because it was important to me. I might not have ever had another big race in me. And actually, that was true. That was my last big race I ever did. But what a way to go out. The last two races I did were two World Championships. Yeah, that's a great way to finish your career.
Mm.
Is there an image? Is there something which sticks in your head or that you feel from that last race? Because we've seen it at the Rugby World Cup just recently, where, you know, guys have come to the end of their career.
Yeah.
Did you know that was the end and you were able to lap that up, or not really?
I still thought I had a bit more in me, if I'm being honest. And I came back, I knew I was carrying a bit of a slight injury when I was out there. And I was always hoping to make a, to find a way out of it. Unfortunately, the injury was, we just couldn't solve the problem. So it wasn't ever a swan song. So I don't have any regrets about that. And then when I retired, I knew then that I never wanted to compete again in anything, because I think when you've competed at the really highest level, the idea of doing something and compete, most I am competitive, certainly in work. I've translated that competitiveness, not in sport, but into business now. And I want to win at everything in business. That's an awful thing to say, but it's true. And I've taken that into there rather than into sport. I did become quite a good cyclist, and still am quite a good one. So I do silly things there that I've done a few big charity rides just to test myself out, just to test my sporting acumen still, if I've still got it. And I don't, by the way.
So, James, is success now for you not measured in gold medals but measured in profit or successful people? How do you enumerate that? How do you work out when you're being successful?
Okay. Do you know what? I've been thinking about this a lot recently, if I'm being honest. Where I am precisely in my career, I see myself very much in the autumn of my career. I really do. And my job... Oh,
you're just a stripling. No, just a boy.
No, I do very much see myself. And in fact, I am genuinely focused on making my line managers now capable to do my job. Mm. And I think, to be honest, a number of them are probably could do it, certainly as well as I can, probably could do it better. But I get satisfaction out of training and coaching people. I professionally mentor people, and these are mature, like master students with a university program that I work with at the moment. And I'm mentoring five people within the AI. I can't do any more than that. That's as much as I can do. Mm. I have this enormous affection for what Adam did for me in my career. And he took me down and he stopped this probably capable manager who was always stopped and frustrated because he was too black and white. And he taught me how to manage. And I see that in a lot of the team that I work with, and I want them not to make the mistake that it took me to 40 to realize what a bit of a prat I was most of the time. And having said that, I wasn't ready to be taught at that stage. I needed to move on from being a sportsman and the way I was. So I needed to be at 40 to accept it. And I want to pass on that knowledge and insight. That's how I really manage success. Money for me was really not my motivation. If you're successful and you do well in business, things will follow through. Of course, on a daily basis and a weekly basis, I report our financial performance internally as a business, and that goes as a given. That's not my motivation. And I read this the other day, and it's never true. Like business strategy and planning is never numbers. It's about the emotional relationship you have with your staff and with your customers. And if you've got that right, you'll do well. Yep. Numbers do, of course, follow through. But numbers are not a strategy. It's the people that help drive and develop you as a business.
So I get satisfied. Wise, wise man. Goodness gracious. Where have you been all my life?
it's taken me a long time to get to there.
But isn't it lovely that, you know, I think because... What we, I think, are experiencing as an industry, and I speak, to the community of electric vehicles and this transition that we're feeling. It does feel like the people that feature most heavily, most strongly in our world are people that are focused on people. And, you know, understanding that the importance of community, the importance of mental health, we talk about it in the EV yeah. Cafe a lot, and that drivenness that comes from all pushing together as a team, you know. Everything. It was really interesting. It's a bit of a just watch the Beckham series on the TV, and when he moved to Real Madrid. And there was a period of time where he just wasn't playing well, or he hadn't got it. But then the team got around him, and then he was ostracized and then brought back in by the team. And the team kind of brought. And you just, it speaks to me that personal, that sort of sustainability, the EV world coming together. And James, you know, do you see that as a good driver, the climate, sustainability, that whole community piece? Is that an important driver to, one, to the AA, but two, to you as James Starling?
Okay, so let's kind of deal with the AA first. That's an easy one. So, you know, we're trying to be at the forefront of innovation, one of my four buckets that I talked about earlier on. So I think our ESG position at times is quite contradictory, if I'm being honest, at the moment in the current climate. So let's deal with the really thorny issue of our roadside fleet. We've got 3,500 diesel guzzlers out there. Today, to do our job as efficiently and as effectively as we need to do, we have to use that product today. I would still argue that the diesel product in the right place is the right tool today. But what we are as a business is we're, you know, ultimately responsible. I just think the power of the AA brand parking that, you know, is just immense. So we have to do the right thing by what the socioeconomic demands of UK PLC are. And just the demands of UK PLC is we have to address that. So we are actively trialing EV product today out in the marketplace. And I think now we've got about 20 Toyota Pro Ace with us at this moment in time, which I think the trial is going remarkably well. The range is actually better than I think we thought, albeit under fully laden circumstances. It's obviously the performance is still not quite there yet. I think what I've been most proud of and recently is the work that we've done around charge post operating. We saw a little niche in the marketplace, I think, and I'd love to say it was all down to me, but I'm sure you know it isn't. Dean Hedger, I think, was a bit of an evangelist. Yeah, but it's been taken over by Esther recently. And we picked up an opportunity. You know, we've got a immature provider market of the CPO. So, well, actually, what they've done is, I think, from what I can see, there are a lot of small entrepreneurial firms who don't have scale to service the market. So is there a way that through the AA we can give them scale to access to the customer, to the consumer, a product that serves their needs in the marketplace? And to his enormous credit, I think Dean grabbed this opportunity working with the likes of yourself. I think if it wasn't for him, we wouldn't be where we are today. And we've now got roughly 30% market share of all of the charge post operators operating in the UK managing their call center. And that's quite a phenomenal achievement. Esther, I think, has taken on as well and evolved it and got it better. We've had challenges with the service provision at times, and I think we have to be honest with that this year. But I do believe now we're operating in a really good place. And we want to evolve our proposition still further with our charge post operators, because not just to be just the provider of the call centre, but actually, would you believe it, charge posts actually do break down. So can we provide a breakdown service in e-commerce to actually mend the charge post at the point of consumer need? So we're looking to develop our proposition to do that. Now, obviously, it's not like a car. So we need people with the appropriate electrical qualifications to be able to do for that work. But we are actively looking to develop that proposition. And I hope probably during the early part of next year to evolve that product proposition still further. And Esther and the team are working on that as we speak. So that's what we're trying to bring to that. At a more personal level, if I was to use that, I would say I do my very best with what I can control. So, for example, I've done the obvious things. I've changed my boiler recently to a more upgraded boiler, I'm a 30-year-old boiler. I know they seem sort of simple things, but by default, it was working really well. Why did I need to change? I thought, no, let's make it more efficient. Gone through, we changed the double glazing in the house in the last 3 years, and in order to make the house more efficient. So I think I'm doing it all within the boundaries of what I think I should do as a good consumer. Am I evangelical? I'd have to be honest with you and say probably not. But I'm doing what I consider the right things within my sphere of influence to control. And I think I'm happy with what I'm doing in that regard.
Sure. It's great that you can kind of see that. And for the record, you know that I'm electric van man or whatever, but I look at the AA fleet and I recognize the argument that is there. My pushback a couple of years ago was, yeah, but you don't tow everything. So there's a lot of stuff. And now what we're seeing as technology comes and catches up with the challenges that we've got outside of the core, we're seeing key vans come along and other different types of vehicle come in. And Simon and Duncan are obviously, keen to push things forward and build the options that are there. And I think we as an industry can learn from the experience that you're going through, because everybody thinks that all we do is bang on about, oh, you've got to change. No, you've got to change the right vehicles with the right vehicles to be able to move at the pace that we need to, which is all clearly laid out for us to get to the end goal, not turn off one tomorrow and turn on another today. And I love the innovation piece as well, where you're doing the whole charge post things as well. And that's sorry, James, I interrupted you. And that's
there was one thing I was just going to say is, I think we've got to call out other fleets who are doing amazing work. I think the AA is doing great work. I was lucky enough to work at Lex, and just before I was leaving, so about 3 years out of date now, but nevertheless, they had started and were well on the way of the journey. It was from Mighty. And you read what Mighty has done with their electrification of company cars and then the movement into vans. Absolutely. And exactly what you said, they phased their approach to the commercial van usage. They started with the small car-derived vans, made them electric. And as they needed to develop their propositions, they changed the way they did it. And I think the AA because of the very rugged nature of the requirements of our thing, is we're a little bit behind the curve. Well, no, we're not behind the curve. We've actually made the right decision based on the business need. And as the market and the OEMs catch up with the needs of our business, we'll be able to move with them. And at the moment, that's where we are. We're on that journey. I hate the journey word, but we're, effectively, that's what we're on.
It's a good lesson we can take away, isn't it? Just being on, we won't say the journey, we're there. That's it. There's a process that we're going through to decarbonize all of transport. And if you happen to be in that place, you're going to be a little bit later. And if you happen to be at this place, we need you to be an early starter, you know, to crack on and do it. It's great. So, John, sorry, I think you had something to say. I was looking at you and you.
I'm inspired by you, you know, James, because here I sit at 58 and I'm thinking, right, I've got another 10 years maybe of work that I'm going to do.
Yeah.
10 years happily falls into 2 5-year boxes. And I'm thinking, all right, I'm going to learn from this because I don't know what my next 10 years is going to look like. And I'm a bit worried about drift. And your approach is one I think I'm going to take on board so that I don't drift. But I do put very discrete boxes in that say in the next 5 years, this is what I want to achieve in my work life and my personal life so that I'm driven to deliver. It makes so much sense to me. Why did I not meet you before?
Well, it's funny enough. I said I've got a number of people I'm working with today, and it's obviously generally slightly younger people, I hate to say it, but actually I still think the rigor is good because what you generally find, and you have, if you're mentoring people, mentoring is not easy because you want to make them really think about the decisions they're making. Mm. And I've had scenarios where people say, I want to become, you know, a senior manager, blah, 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 and all that sort of thing. Then they say, I want to have a family and all that sort of stuff, mortgage, blah, blah, blah. And you say, well, how can you square the two circles up? If you want to be a real family man or family lady, yet you want to be a senior, there's always a trade-off. And people say to me, you can have both. I'm sorry, I don't actually believe that, children. And and I think there is a trade-off on these sort of things. And I found the visualization of that so easy for me. Now, another big clue I will give you and to anyone that is listening to this one, when you write your list in your boxes, it really pays off my team, is I always look at the order of them. Now, for me, the most important one should always be at the top and going down. When I see people do this exercise, they always do it and they just scattergun stuff. And then you sit down afterwards and you have a chapter, well, why have you done it that way? And they have, you know, they've done the order, they've not thought about it properly. Mm-hmm. So whilst I'm giving them this rough framework, then it's what you actually stick in it and the order is really important because that should drive your priorities and so on and so forth. So within all of that, I do that. And there was a book I read by Jack Welch, who I don't know if you've come across him before, but the former CEO of a GE, one of the most amazing guys I've ever met. And he said, I only used to do everything in threes. And so he has lists of threes, and then he has sub-lists of threes within the threes. Mm. But he found by doing that was a way to do it. And likewise, when you're doing your 5-year plans, you might have three in each column. So on your private life and on your work life, make sure they're in order because that should be the focus on which you do things. In my view.
James, I wonder if we need to work collaboratively on some kind of approach because I can see the Starling approach to life coming forward here as an idea and that, you know, developing this in blocks of three, that makes absolute sense to me. It resonates. Yeah. You're a very, very clever man and you've achieved a great deal. Is there anything left for you?
No, well, I don't know. I think for me, I want to, I suppose if I've got my next 3 years, I've been at the AA now 2 and a bit years. So I think I've got about another, you know, maximum 3 years on my 5-year horizon. I think you want to, my predecessor did a wonderful job that I inherited a wonderful back office infrastructure. And that's not my greatest strength, I must admit. But what I am good at is front office side of the equation. So I want to leave the business in now a better balanced position than it was when I joined. Mm-hmm. And I think we're well on the way. I want a team of people who are engaged and what's the word I'm looking for? Ready to take the mantle on to take the business to the next level. Really, I do. And I think the third thing is obviously then you want to drive for success. What does success mean in my world? Have I increased the P&L size? Have I driven EBITDA growth and all those sort of things? But have I got customers that are coming with us on that journey? And they're actually wanting to not just take roadside. I've told you my ambition is that we want 85% revenues only from roadside. I want 15% to come from these other areas. And if we've got that happening, then that's kind of my success that I want for our business at the end of the day and my team that work for me. Mm. So that's really simple stuff. But the thing is, it's really simple. And I think you have to be really simple in your thought process because I find if things are really simple, then things get delivered a lot easier. And I go back to one of my earliest days when I was a rep, when I worked for Ford. And I went out to a dealer site. Oh, this is going to be an awful story, but hopefully I get it the way I want to say it. As I went out to these dealers and there was this top performing dealer that was the best at selling finance and insurance. And I had been and I repped and covered loads and loads of dealers in Southeast England. This was for Ford. But this one dealer was like this beacon of brilliance in terms of its sales performance. And I said to the guy who was the sales controller, I said, how the hell do you do it? And having reflected on it, I couldn't see the answer myself. And he said, oh, James, it's really simple. Is I tell the sales guys as little as I can about finance, prices and all that. And I get them to focus on the selling, the features and the benefits of the car. I control behind the back thing because the more they know about finance. Now, you probably can't do it today in a regulatory world and all that good stuff. But in the way that he sold at the time, he said, I keep it really simple for the salesman to do what they're really good at, selling cars, I'll do the other stuff. And I thought to myself, that's really, to me, in a nutshell, keep things as simple as possible for me as a salesperson, back to my 4 points that I said at the start, back to how I think I get best benefit from my teams I've worked for. And I've learned this over the years. If you have 3 or 4 things only to focus on, and do them brilliantly, that probably looks after 90% plus of your business. My boss is amazing. My two bosses. I've got Dean Keeling, who's my immediate boss, and I've got Jakob Faugler, who's the CEO of our business. I've probably never worked with two people who have this insatiable need to work and drive constant, like, innovative thoughts. But they give you hundreds of ideas and hundreds of things to get on with. But you generally find if you do 3 things brilliantly, you've probably got 90% of what they want. And I try to protect my team from all of the huge noise that comes from them, filter it down to make it as easy as possible. And that's what I do. That's what I think.
The thing you mentioned best was that you keep it simple. Talking is simple. Here's Paul.
Well, you know, I've had some introductions in my time, and that wasn't one of them. Anyway, James, it is important to keep it simple. It really is. And simply, you've been brilliant. The AA have been brilliant for the EV Cafe. And, as part of that, your purpose in sustainability, your support and community and people, you've supported the community of the EV Cafe, but also the messaging of the EV Cafe. And I think it's really, it's a synergy that really gives value that is beyond the sum of the parts, or certainly from our perspective anyway, because you're a very powerful business. And we wouldn't be the organization that we are today without the support of the AA. And we'd like to think we've added something along the way for you guys too, and it's
a huge amount.
But it's the most important thing is that simplicity, that drive, that passion to make a difference, to go with innovation, to deal with the difficult things like your own fleet, and deal with those head on. And what I've not heard today is a rose-tinted kind of exposition of the AA and how wonderful you all are. There's been a bit of realness, a bit of rawness there of this is the journey we're all on, and it's not simple and it's not easy, and your own personal journey as well. I've really enjoyed this. John, it's been a really good conversation, isn't it?
I can't stress enough how important the process is for me to take away from this. And I just love, met you 55 minutes ago, James, and I never imagined for a second that we would peel back the layers of your onion to see such depth. You are a heck of a man and a heck of a human being, and it's a privilege to have spent the last hour with you. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the time. You know, I see it as just the truth, and I've been around the block a bit, and hopefully people can learn a few things from me. And back to the EV calf, you know, again, I see this as a very mutual relationship. As soon as you don't see it as mutual, again, you fail as a business person. Yeah. There has to be stuff that both parties benefit from, but ultimately with the aim of what we're trying to achieve, which is a better environment that we all work in, and they're actually driving growth and innovation in UK PLC. And I'm delighted, the AA is delighted to be part of the relationship with EV CAF. And I
bless you, thank
hope that's all we can ask for.
Continue to sort of that with that investment for years. And yeah, exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. James, listen, it's been an incredible pleasure today. We so value your time, you know, in the role that you have, time must be so precious. But for you to share it with not only us, but all of the people that will listen to it, I think many, many people will benefit from that. So do listen, everybody, check out James Starling and his athletic career. You could Google him and find out more about him, and also you can find out all about the AA from the EV Cafe page. But James, it's been a fantastic pleasure and a privilege to be chatting with you today. Mm-hmm. And we look forward to, as you pointed out, that long and fruitful relationship that we will have together. Okay. But also the value that the AA Business Services will add to industry. So thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much, guys. Nice to see you both.
Bless you.
And everybody, check back on the EV Cafe website for more podcasts just like this one. And, do follow us on LinkedIn. Follow the AA on LinkedIn as well. Connect with all that social stuff. But let's join hands and run off into the daisies again and make a difference. Have a great day, everybody.
Thanks, guys. See you later.